Perfect. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay. I'm from Chicago, and I am going to be your host for the presentation today. Today is Sunday, September 8th, 2024. Let me give you the share ID numbers for Friday, September 6th. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 21,722. That's 21722. For the 10 a.m. meeting, Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number, 21,723. That's 21723. This morning, A Vision for You presents Underworked but Not Undervalued, Step 2 and Step 10. So our speaker is going to elaborate on these steps and how they can be, you know, sometimes misinterpreted and undervalued. And so we're going to get some good information on that. So as a brief lead into the presentation this morning, I'm going to share with you a personal experience of mine from many years ago that has helped shape how I've, you know, come really to value the wonderful teachers we have in this program. And more importantly, how I've come to discern good, helpful guidance versus, you know, perhaps less helpful guidance. Which I've certainly encountered both in this program and in my lifetime. Because, you know, given the fact that we're facing more than just a sort of inconvenient problem, right? But rather, we're dealing with a deadly disease. The Big Book is very clear that it is a grave disease. So it stands to reason that I need good information and I need good guidance, right? And so here's my experience. You know, when I was in graduate school, there were, you know, many professors, but two that stuck out for me. So this was decades ago, right? And the first was kind of a younger sort of hotshot professor. Boy, did he have the goods in terms of paper, what was on paper. Now, he was very young, but boy, did he have the goods. I mean, he came from, you know, from the elite college with the background, and he really looked good on paper. And furthermore, not just that, he was also sort of, you know, he spoke about the cutting edge of technology. He gave his interpretations of the text and so forth. And he was, and many folks, probably including me back then, was really enamored with this guy. And he just had, he was a very charismatic, dynamic young person. I'll tell you what he didn't have, and I didn't know it at the time, but I can tell you today. What he didn't have was a lot of wisdom. It's not that maybe today, I'm sure, wisdom, he probably has a lot of it, but he didn't have a lot of wisdom, but he certainly, he was someone that really, very charismatic. He was kind of a contrarian. So he would look at the research and he could really expound upon these things, and he would give, you know, contrarian views just almost on anything. And he was, you know, somewhat argumentative, but in a, you know, in a reasonable way, you could be combative and that sort of thing. But boy, did a lot of people, including me, because I was a young, impressionable student, didn't know much. He really, and he looked good and the whole deal, right? So the second professor I'm going to speak of didn't come from the background. This was an elderly gentleman. And he wasn't necessarily, he was a pretty good speaker. I remember him, but he didn't come from he didn't have all the, you know, the great university experience, probably, you know, went to junior college and then later on and transferred in like a lot of us and, you know, and that kind of thing. And he was not a full-time professor either. He was you know, sort of a part-time, because he was so busy for decades working in the trenches in my field of study, which is psychology. He had a lot of experience, lived experience in that stuff, right? And furthermore, he could speak from experience in some of these different troubling areas, because in his own life, he had a lot of those things. And, you know, it speaks to, as I you know, kind of come to, you know, conclude, that wisdom can't be attained on the fly. You know what I mean? Wisdom is a gradual process that's usually characterized, it's shaped by experience, it's shaped by reflection, introspection, I think wisdom comes with a great deal of humility. I've come to realize that, but I didn't take stock in humility for many years, for sure. And more than anything else, wisdom comes from, again, this life experience over time. Someone that's been beaten up and bloodied, and someone in the trenches, but that's someone that has had an experience, you know. And so I guess the moral of my story is, you know, for me as much as anyone else, I didn't preach to anybody, that's for sure, be careful in choosing your teachers, you know, because I don't think it's an exaggeration to suggest that choosing the wrong teacher in this deal, in these rooms, this grave dilemma that we read about, body, can be the difference between not just a bad day, a bad week, bad month. It's really the difference between life and death for someone like me. So, you know, be careful on the teachers we choose. You know, that's really important. So joining us this morning is a guy that didn't have a whole lot of wisdom way back when, but the only wise thing I think that this guy always had from decades ago was he was a Cubs fan. That's about it. Other than that, his early stuff, I didn't see a lot of wisdom there. Now I see more wisdom from beaten and bloodied in the trenches, understands the book, connect the dots, all that kind of stuff. Okay, I have a bit of a bias there. But, I mean, I'm not the only one that does. But, other than a Cubs fan, didn't have much to offer me back in the day. But joining us this morning to talk to share his experience, particularly steps 2 and 10, he never was the first baseman for the Cubs, but he knew all of them. He can tell you every first baseman,
yeah,
from years and years is Harlan G. And Harlan G. resides in Scottsdale, Arizona. Don't let him kid you. He's from Chicago originally, born and raised. So please join me in welcoming this guy, Harlan G. Good morning, Harlan.
Thank you, Larry. Good morning, my friend. Good morning. And yes, I am a Cubs fan, so as of this morning, I'm definitely crying in my beer because they haven't scored a run in 2 games against the darn Yankees, and they've got to score some runs. This is ridiculous, and I don't know what's going on over there. Anyway, as Larry said, I am Harlan G., and I am a recovered compulsive overeater, and I live in Scottsdale, Arizona, as was mentioned, and I'm so glad to be here this morning. What an honor for thousands and thousands of years, going back to King Solomon. In King Solomon in the Old Testament wrote in the Book of Solomon that he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he had no remedy for it. Notice I didn't use the word cure. He had no remedy for it, and he couldn't prove it, but he believed that it was an illness. In England, back in the 1640s, around the time of Shakespeare, there was a guy who was believing that alcoholism was an illness. His name was Dr. Trotter. And Dr. Trotter wrote a paper in 1640, and he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he had no remedy for it, and he couldn't prove it. The very first Surgeon General of the United States of America, and in 1790, his name was Benjamin Rush. He wrote a paper in 1790 that he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and there was no remedy for it. There was no way for him to prove it or to give you any solace, any relief from alcoholism. He just couldn't do it. And in New York City in the 1920s, there was a guy, and his name was Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. And without William Duncan Silkworth, there is no program. A lot of people, as well they should, they give Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and Jimmy Burwell and Fitz Mayo and, of course, Hank Parkhurst for sure. They give these guys a lot of credit, and well we should. But Silkworth is the little doctor who loved drunks and Dr. Silkworth had a theory, and he published a paper. He didn't publish a paper, that was Harry Thiebaud. Dr. Silkworth believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it necessarily, but he knew it like he knew his name. He just knew that this was an illness. And Harry Thiebaud, in 1945, wrote a paper. Harry Thiebaud was a New York psychiatrist, and he had a patient whose name was Bill Wilson. And Harry Thiebaud's paper in 1950 was accepted by the American Psychiatric Association and the American Medical Association. And in 1950, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association accepted the fact that alcoholism was an illness. Now, why am I talking about that this morning? We're not here to talk about step one, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of the background so that we could get a running start on step two. And for thousands and thousands of years, people afflicted with alcoholism, compulsive overeating, gambling, whatever they were addicted to. Yes, they did have drug addicts hundreds and hundreds of years ago. There were wars fought over opium, 500-600 years ago. Absolutely. The drugs were different. The packages were different, but we definitely had it. There was just nothing that could be done. Now, I want you to take your imagination as you're listening this morning, and I want you to go to Rhode Island. And Rhode Island is the smallest of American states, but the impact on our program comes from a man who was born and raised there, and his name was Roland Hazard. And Roland Hazard was from Rhode Island, and he was a very successful businessman. His family had been in America for hundreds of years. They came over in the late 1600s, and they established a company called Burlington Mills. And if you've ever walked on a carpet in your life, the chances are excellent that the carpet that you're walking on is from Burlington. They also were major stockholders later in a company that is still very, very important, and it is called Allied Chemical. These were very wealthy people. And they had a wayward son named Roland. Roland Hazard was an alcoholic, and he was a really, really bad alcoholic. Not that there's good alcoholics, but he was really bad. Not that there's good. But anyway, Roland Hazard had a lot of money, so he had himself sequestered on a Caribbean island in the late 1920s. And on this island, the quartermaster who came for the year he was on the island was instructed never to bring him liquor of any kind. And he didn't. He didn't bring him any liquor. And so for the year that Roland sequestered himself on this desert island, he didn't drink. He didn't get drunk. And he figures, all right, I'm cured. I'm going to go back to the States, and the very first place he lands is Miami, Florida. From the Caribbean, he lands in Miami. And what do they have in Miami? You guessed it, liquor, bars, saloons, liquor stores, what have you. And he's drunk within a very short period of time. Very short period of time. Roland is absolutely dead drunk.
And hey, Harlan, can you stop for a second? I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm hearing some background in the noise there, and I don't want to miss anything, and I know no one else does. I'm muted. I don't know if the board op is muted, but if we can mute the lines and then make sure that, there we go. Thanks, Harlan. I don't want to miss anything. Sorry for the interruption. Okay. So, Harlan, you might have to star one again to come in.
Okay, star one again. Was that background coming from me, or was it coming from someone else?
No, I don't think so. You're usually pretty. It was like shuffling papers, keyboard kind of stuff.
I
think we're good
that's
now.
That's definitely not me. Okay.
Cool.
All right. So anyway, it's 1931. And a lot of things are coming together. Psychiatry was sort of in its infancy phase. And Roland figures he's going to go to the top man in psychiatry, whose name was Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud wasn't taking on any new patients at this time. And so he says to Freud, well, who's the number two man in this operation? And Freud says, the number two man here is Dr. Adler. So Roland goes to Dr. Adler. And in his quest for a relief from his alcoholism, he goes to Adler, and Adler says, I'm sorry, I'm not taking on any new patients. And Adler tells Roland, Roland asks Adler, who's the number three man in this operation? He's figuring, what the heck's going on here? And he says, you have to go to Switzerland, and you have to go to Carl Jung. Carl Jung lives in Switzerland, in Geneva, and Carl Jung is the number three man. He gets in touch with Carl Jung in 1931, and he goes to a hospital in Geneva, and he checks himself in. You can't really do that today. They're not hotels, huh? You can't just say, I want to check in. But with Roland's money and with the depression, that, you know, when the United States catches cold, the world catches pneumonia, so they were glad to have Roland. So in 1931, Roland Hazard put himself in the care of Dr. Carl Jung in Switzerland. And for 1 year, Carl Jung psychoanalyzed Roland Hazard, the alcoholic, and at the end of the year, now in the hospital, there was no liquor. Nobody brought him any. Nobody, you know, gave him any. And for a year, Roland stayed sober. And Jung says, I've psychoanalyzed you. You're ready to go back to the United States. And the first stop in Roland's quest to go back to the United States is Paris, France. And he goes to Paris, he gets off the railroad, and who does he run into but friends of his parents who were very wealthy, who could afford a Paris vacation in the middle of the Depression? Only the very wealthy. And they say, Roland, my boy, what are you doing here? And he explains to them about his quest for sobriety and how Carl Jung had psychoanalyzed him for a year. Now, this is 1932. Carl Jung had psychoanalyzed him for a year, and he was sober. And they said, Roland, we've got to celebrate your sobriety, boy. We've got to celebrate, young man. And they busted a bottle of Paris's famous best champagne. And Roland, within a very short period of time, is incapacitated, unable to move. He goes back to Dr. Jung, and he goes back to Dr. Jung and says, Dr. Jung, you must help me. And Carl Jung says to Roland, now this is all described on pages 26 and 27 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, 26 and 27, he says, Roland, I have misdiagnosed you. I'm very sorry, but you are going to die. You are an alcoholic. Roland says, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, I don't want to die. Please tell me what I can do. He says to the doctor, is there no exception? Now, is it odd or is it God that Roland didn't get to Freud or Adler, because Freud and Adler believed that all solution lie within the cerebral, all solution lie within the mind. But Jung broke rank with Freud and Adler, and he believed, as described on 27, here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. It's on page 27. And he says, to me, these occurrences are phenomena. He calls it a phenomena because he couldn't really describe, he couldn't really explain it, but he just knew it was there. They appear to be in the, now listen to how many times Dr. Jung is going to refer to the concept of change. Listen to this. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements, change, and rearrangements, change. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, change, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begins to dominate them. Change. In fact, I have been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement, change, within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. So Dr. Jung imparts upon Roland, and this is where it comes from, this is the emanation point, of a spiritual solution to Roland's addiction. This is 1932. Roland goes back to the United States, and on sheer willpower and enthusiasm, drinks nothing of drinks nothing that has liquor in it, and doesn't want to go to a conventional church, but he wants to go to something, somewhere, that can give him a spiritual experience. I know in the questions and answers, we're going to get what's the difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. Spiritual experience is very fast. It happens all of a sudden. A spiritual awakening happens over time. That's the only difference. And Roland Hazard goes in to the Oxford Group movement. Now, the Oxford Group movement is often mistaken for a place to go with your alcoholism. It was not that at all. The Oxford Group movement was nothing of the kind. They were people practicing first century Christianity to the very best of their ability. That's what they were. And they were founded by Frank Buchman, and they were people that were trying to instill enthusiasm for their Christianity. Enthusiasm is a good word. It comes from the Greek word entheos, from God. And Roland goes into the cavalry mission in New York City, and he meets Sam Shoemaker. Reverend Shoemaker is the American point man for the Oxford Group. He was an Episcopal minister, and he introduces Roland to a guy by the name of Shep Cornell and a guy by the name of Seabrook Graves Jr. And Seabrook Graves Jr. is also an alcoholic, staying sober with no knowledge of the problem. See, we get the problem from Dr. Silkworth, and we get the solution from Dr. Jung, the spiritual experience. So this is how they come together, but we're going to see them coming together in just a few minutes here. Now, Seabrook Graves Jr. and Roland eventually end up as friends, as Shep Cornell, and what binds them together is they are not only people seeking solace in the Oxford Group movement, but they are also alcoholics. Now, I want you to turn your attention to Albany, New York. And in Albany, New York, we're going to look on a friend called Edwin Ebbe Thatcher. Edwin Ebbe Thatcher was a drunk who was sent by his family to go to Manchester, Vermont, which is right across from East Dorset, Vermont. And who was born in East Dorset, Vermont? You guessed it, our friend Bill Wilson. And Ebbe was a drunk, bad drunk. Not that there's good drunks. He was a bad drunk. Okay, now, Edwin Ebbe Thatcher is in trouble in Manchester for his drinking. Lots of trouble he's getting into. And in August of 1934, Ebbe Thatcher is arrested after driving drunk right into a woman's kitchen. And rather than showing any remorse or any contrition, he hops out of the car with open liquor in the car, driving into her kitchen. He gets out drunk and says, "Hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee?" She calls the police in late August, of 1934, and Ebbie Thatcher in September of 1934 is about to be remanded to the state insane asylum in Vermont, in Brattleboro, Vermont. That's what they did with alcoholics in those days. They put you in an insane asylum. They didn't know what else to do with you. And in September of 1934, Roland Hazard and Seber Graves Jr. were visiting East Dorset, Vermont, because Seber Graves Jr.'s father and mother lived there with their family. And Seber Graves Jr. and Roland hear about Ebbie Thatcher, and they decide they're going to try to get Ebbie, they're going to try to get the judge to remand Ebbie, not to the insane asylum, but to their care. And in remanding him to their care, they would take Ebbie to the Oxford Group meetings in New York and introduce him to Sam Shoemaker and the Oxford Group. The judge in the case of Ebbie was Seber Graves Sr. Was it odd or was it God? And so Seber Graves Sr. puts it to Ebbie in September of 1934. Would you rather go to the insane asylum or go to the Oxford Group meetings with these guys here? They knew of Ebbie. They knew of each other. He says, I don't want to go with these holy rollers. That's what he called them, holy rollers. But he says, anything's better than the insane asylum. So in September of 1934, Ebbie Thatcher goes to New York City, and he attends Oxford Group meetings with no knowledge of the problem of his alcoholism. He is staying sober from September to October, and from October to November, Ebbie now has 2 months of sobriety. This is late 1934. Ebbie is sober. And they tell Ebbie in 1934, in November of 1934, he must go give testimony. What is going to give testimony? They say, you must go tell somebody what Christ did for you. Ebbie says, I don't want to go give testimony. And they said, oh, that's fine. You don't have to. We'll remand you back to the judge in Vermont, and he'll remand you to the Brattleboro Insane Asylum in Brattleboro, Vermont. And Ebbie says, you know, I think I'll go give some testimony. And he thinks, and he says to himself, I could go see Bill Wilson and not embarrass myself. And in November of 1934, Ebbie Thatcher is going to call upon Bill Wilson on a bleak November night, and he's going to change the world forever. And he calls upon Bill Wilson, and he imparts upon Bill Wilson the reason that he's sober. And the reason that he's sober is because he says at that time, I've got religion. And Bill Wilson is struggling with this idea. It's all recounted on pages 9, 10, 11. And on page 12, we see the confluence of the problem and the solution. The problem and the solution. The problem was given to Bill Wilson by Dr. Silkworth. Ebbie brought him the solution to the problem, which he didn't know, and Silkworth didn't know either. And on page 12 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, at the moment that this occurred, it says on page 12, thus was I convinced, I'm three-quarters of the way down the page, was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. How do I demonstrate that I want him enough? By doing the steps. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. What did he see? He saw recovery. He saw recovery. He had seen alcoholics and heavy drinkers in the town's hospital not drinking, but the alcoholics were miserable when they weren't drinking. They were miserable, and Ebbie was happy in his release. So he saw recovery. What did he feel? He felt hope. What did he believe? He believed that God could and would solve his problem if he sought God. So step two comes into our program right at that moment in 1934 when Bill Wilson, who knew the problem, Ebbie didn't know the problem, Ebbie knew the solution, didn't know the problem, Bill knew the problem, didn't have a solution. At that moment, the worlds came together to bring us our step two. And our step two is came to believe that a power greater than myself, than ourselves, could restore us to sanity. Now, notice it doesn't say came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sobriety. Notice it doesn't say came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to abstinence, because sanity has a much higher ceiling than sobriety. Sobriety is a bare beginning. This week, tomorrow, in A Vision for You, don't miss it, tune in tomorrow, because tomorrow we are going to read the thesis line of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thesis line on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that we are going to read tomorrow is, well, that's exactly what this about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Doesn't say the main object of this book is to help you get sobriety. This is all a process. Yes, sobriety is very important. And when I come into OA meetings, and I'm here 45 years, I came in February 2nd of 1979, miserable Friday night in February. And what I heard then is the same thing I hear today, that abstinence is the most important thing in my life without exception. Not for me, thank you. Now, please do not come away from this special edition and call up the main office of OA or the main office of the world and say, Harlan said we don't have to be abstinent. I never said that. What I said is abstinence is not the most important thing in my life without exception. My relationship with God is. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now, what are some of the ways that I do that? Well, I pray, absolutely. Yes, I pray and I meditate and I do my step 11 every day. But what does it say at the bottom of 14? What does it say at the bottom of page 14? It tells me everything I need to know at the bottom of page 14. It says, my friend, and he's talking about Ebbie, had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles. What are the principles? The principles are the steps. Sometimes you'll hear people say, well, the principle of this is hope, and the principle of this is honesty. And that's not what Bill's talking about. That stuff came out after Bill was gone at the big meeting in the sky. He's just using another word for the steps. In all my affairs, step 12. Particularly, was it imperative? What's imperative? Imperative is important above all else. To work with others as he had worked with me. If I'm not sponsoring, I am not working on my spiritual life. I am not capturing the essence of step two, and the essence of it is I've come to believe. So that's not an event, that's a process. If Bill wanted it to be an event, he would have said, believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. It is came to believe. I will be working step two until they're lowering me in the ground. It says here, faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. Pay attention to this part. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, how do I do that? Through work and self-sacrifice for others, sponsorship. He could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Faith without works is dead, and works without faith is dead. And one of the things we all get just ripped up about is, God wasn't there for me. I was fat, or I was this, or I was that. Or the Holocaust, or slavery, or the Trail of Tears. All these things are horrible things. You know, last week I had an opportunity to visit the Holocaust Museum in Skokie, Illinois. I was visiting my girlfriend. And me and my girlfriend went to the Holocaust Museum in Skokie. It's quite a moving experience. And as we were coming out of there, we were talking about ourselves, but there's also a lot of people, and I hear this all the time, I can't believe in God because of the Holocaust. I can't believe in God because of racial prejudice. Or I can't believe in God because of the damn politics. Or I, you know, there's multitudes of reasons why we can't believe. Nobody is telling you in step two that you have to become a theologian. Nobody is telling you in step two that you have to have this, you have to go to the yeshiva and get a smicha. A smicha is like a license, is the best way to describe it, to be a rabbi. Nobody's telling you to go to the yeshiva. Nobody's telling you to go to the seminary, and the monastery, and the this. Nobody's telling you that you have to be a theologian or a historian. All that's required of you is to read page 47. In the middle of the page, it says, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? You can be an atheist. You can be an agnostic. You can be a believer. But all that's necessary in this program is to believe or be willing to believe that there is a power greater than yourself. Now, another thing I want to address about this Holocaust thing and the slavery thing, racial prejudice, these are all horrible things. God didn't put a bunch of robots on the earth. He put people. People can do good. People can do bad. God cried to walk me through this. If you can convince me that me eating ice cream today will bring back one victim of slavery or racial injustice or the Trail of Tears or the Holocaust, walk me through how me dying in the food is going to help those people. You walk me through it, and I will buy the ice cream today, and by tonight I'll probably be dead. Walk me through it. And when me and my girlfriend were there at the Holocaust Museum, I was thinking, and I think she was too, of the people who think, oh, I can't work this program because of this or that. You know what? BS. How does you dying help them? How does me dying, I'll be damned if those guys are going to kill one more Jew in me. I'll be damned if me eating ice cream and dying way before my time is going to help them, because it's not. I'm fighting battles that just don't exist. And it's time to knock it off and get serious about this program. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Sanity means all levels of my life. Now, there are pockets of agnosticism that I struggle with all the time. Yes, I'm very clear. I must give my food to God. But notice in We Agnostics, he doesn't say to those agnostics, to the agnostic, or you agnostics. He says, we agnostics. Why is that? Because all of us, including me, have pockets of agnosticism. What does that mean? That means I'm willing to give up my food to God. But what about my romantic life? I have a great girlfriend. Sometimes I act stupid. Sometimes I say stupid things. Sometimes I do stupid things. What about my finances? Am I willing to give those to God? I must be willing to give God everything. And if there are vestiges of my life that I'm going to try to hold on to and control myself, I am going to be in trouble. came to believe. I work on my spiritual life every day. I do a short gratitude list every day. I remind myself what I saw today that was beautiful. I do my step 11s. I sponsor, and I have a sponsor. I do service. I do what is expected of me in this program. I give service when I can, and I am always at the ready to help anybody I can help if I can help them. But I've got to help myself and say, I need to give everything to God. Everything. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity is not an event. It is a lifetime process. And it has to be worked on. And if it's not worked on, me eating the food will be right behind it, because this is not a diet club. Now, weight is important. Abstinence is very important. Remember I mentioned before, I don't want you to get all upset because I said abstinence is not the most important thing in my life. It's still a requirement. When I went to college, I went to Roosevelt University in downtown Chicago. They said you have to take English 101 and English 102. And without English 101 and English 102, you can't register for any 2, 3, and 400 level classes. So you can't graduate. So I had to complete English 101 and English 102. We won't talk about the math. That's a sore subject. But I finished those classes, just like abstinence is a required class for my spiritual growth. Abstinence is like the ramp on the highway that gets me on the highway. If I don't have abstinence, I can't get on the highway. Abstinence is a bare minimum. My relationship with God is the key here. Jimmy Burwell was a militant atheist, and he recovered because he was willing to believe that there was a power greater than himself that would restore him to sanity. Doesn't have to be the God in the sky with the white beard. It doesn't have to be the God that screwed you over as a kid or this or that. The freshness date on my unhappy childhood has expired. We've all had pain. We've all had suffering. Some of us more than others have had illnesses. It's time to get a new God for me. It's time for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And not only do I believe he will, I know he will, and so I am willing to serve, and I am willing to sponsor, and I am willing to do whatever that may take. Now, I could go on and on about step two. I could do it, but we don't have the time. Maybe another time we will. But this is another step that we're going to talk about today, and that's step 10. That's step 10. Another underutilized step. Step 10 is not something that you text to somebody. It's not something that you email to somebody. It's something that you do. I'm on page 84. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue. And the word continue is going to be in this paragraph four times. That means we do this throughout our life. A woman in New Jersey came up to me years ago. I hope she's listening this morning. She came up to me and she said, can I call you when I'm done with the steps? And I said, no. And she looked at me like I was the creature from the Black Lagoon. How could I say no? Because when you're done with the steps, you'll be dead. You'll be dead. We continue to work these steps every day for the rest of our life. There is no done. Remember when we talked about the title page to the book, Alcoholics Anonymous? It's an equilateral triangle with recovery, service, and unity as the three legs of the equilateral triangle. What surrounds the triangle? A circle. What does the circle represent? It represents perpetuity. If you're looking at your fourth edition, it's not in there because AA lost the copyright on the first edition. That's why you see these red big books running around. That's another company that jumped on AA's mistake. But anyway, it's It's the circle. That means we continue to do this throughout our life. This thought brings us to step 10. I'm on page 84, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. I do 4 steps from time to time. I just got done telling you I have a great girlfriend. I have money issues. I have friend issues. I have health issues. I have whatever issues. And sometimes I say stupid things, do stupid things, whatever that may be, and I have to sit down and find out what the heck is going on inside me. And the best way for me to do that is to do a 4th step so I can do my 5th step with my sponsor and get some feedback on what he thinks is going on. And continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Not after we cleaned up the past, as we cleaned up the past. And that means we will begin step 10 as we do 8 and 9. We clean up the past in 8 and 9. So the minute we're done with our 4th step, we're going to do 5. Then we're going to take an hour. Then we're going to do 6 and 7. That should take about 30 seconds. If 6 and 7 take longer than 30 seconds, you're probably doing them incorrectly. And then we're going to start on 8. And the minute we start on 8 and we're going to begin 9, we start doing 10 steps and 11 steps. Because that is what is told to us here. As we cleaned up the past, we have entered the world of the Spirit. And the world of the Spirit to me means I am becoming, I'm not there yet, I'm becoming the man God intended me to be. Because when I'm in the food, I'm not really a person. Not really a person. Now that I'm not in the food, I am becoming, although I make mistakes, I'm becoming the man God wanted me to be. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Now, this next continue is the specific instructions on the spot check inventory that I do several times a day. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What step did we use to continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear? Step 4. So 10 is going to be like a mini 4th step here. When these crop up, notice it doesn't say if they crop up, when these crop up, because no matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. We ask God at once to remove them. What step did we use to ask God to remove our defects of character? 6 and 7. We discuss them with someone immediately. That means I make a phone call, not a text, not an email, not smoke signals. What does the big book tell me? A solitary self-appraisal proved insufficient. I need feedback from an objective person. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone, steps 8 and 9. So right there, so far, we have done 4, 6, 7, 5, 8, and 9. I dare you to do 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, and 12 every day, 3, 4 times, 5 times, whatever it is, a day, and eat ice cream. You can't do it. So I'm going to discuss it with someone immediately means I'm going to talk to them, and they're going to give me some objective feedback. Make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help, step 12. And love and tolerance of others is our code. So in this little half paragraph, we are working steps. I'm going to make a call to discuss what's going on with me. It doesn't have to be a 2-hour phone call. It can be 3 minutes. It can be a 3-minute phone call. And my sponsor or someone else will tell me this, this, and this. And it makes all the difference in the world. I just feel so much better. And then I'm going to go help someone else. That makes me feel better. And when I feel better, I don't want to eat ice cream. I don't want to eat Chips Ahoy cookies. I just don't want to. I can't fight the urge to eat Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. I will lose that battle every single time. But when my mind doesn't see the need to make me feel better because I already feel better, I don't have that struggle with the food. And this 10th step is one of the most underutilized steps you will find. People say, well, I do them at night. That's your nightly review in step 11, not step 10. There's nothing in 10 that says you do them at night. Nothing. You do them when you need them. If you need them at night, yeah, do them at night. But you do them immediately. You do it in the moment that you are disturbed. So these can be very misunderstood. Now, I want to leave time for questions and answers. But before I give this back to Larry, I just want to reiterate something that's very, very important. Because I have been in this program a long time doesn't qualify me as an expert on diddly squat. But I have taken hundreds and hundreds of phone calls. And the hundreds and hundreds of phone calls I have taken are mostly people that struggle with this idea in step two that God has to be a certain way or a certain religion, or how can I believe in God when? How can I believe in God if? How can I believe in God because? And we have got to shed ourselves of the reasons not to believe and imbue ourselves with reasons that we must believe. And here's the reason. I want to live my fullest life. I'm sorry about all these extraneous things. I'm sorry that you may have been victimized by crime or cruelty or neglect. I'm sorry, and I've had my struggles too. I have been an object of ridicule in my life. I was 335 pounds as a senior at Mather High School in Chicago. I was 500 pounds by the time I was a sophomore in college. I was 600 pounds when I graduated college. I went on my first date with a girl. I was 35 years old. I have been an object of ridicule. I couldn't get in and out of a car. I couldn't wipe my own ass. I couldn't wear clothes. The swelling in my lower extremities was so profuse, I had dime and penny size ulcers where the pus used to run out of my legs. Children used to laugh at me. Adults used to laugh at me. I have known pain and I have known loneliness. I have known an asexual existence. I had an existence in my life where the only people that ever touched me were people that came up to me that I didn't even know, slapped my ass and grabbed my stomach, and I didn't even know them, and I had to pretend it didn't bother me. I have known pain. I know what it's like to be ridiculed. I know what it's like to be excluded from life. I do. I feel your pain. You convince me that me eating ice cream or fried chicken is going to bring one person back from the Trail of Tears. You convince me that me eating ice cream is going to right the wrongs of racial prejudice, and you convince me that me eating ice cream is going to bring one person back from the gas chamber, and I will eat it gladly. I will trade my life for theirs. But that's a swap I don't have the power to make. So me living my life is the best thing. I am the dream of the people in my life who were murdered because of their religion. My grandparents on my father's side, my cousins, my uncles, my aunts, his brothers and sisters, his nieces and nephews as young as 6 weeks, up to his father of 70-some years, were obliterated off the face of the earth. And for what reason? Because they prayed a different way. They were murdered. I know a little bit about injustice, too. I know a little bit about the sting of murder, too. I lived with a father who witnessed it firsthand. I lived with a father who heard the sounds and smelled the smells and saw the sights and heard the screaming. And this is how I live my life. And step two tells me, I have to live. I am their dream. You are their dream. Knock it off. Knock off the bullshit. And get yourself in line with an idea of a higher power that you can or be willing to believe in. And let's get this recovery thing down, because your life is important too. And if you dying from this disease could help them, I would say go die. But it's not. And as far as step 10 goes, start using it, and start using it the way it is here in the book. It's simple, it's quick, and it's efficient, and it works. All right, Larry, I'm going to shut up now. We've covered 2 and 10 as best as I can in an hour. It takes me a lot longer than that. I'm very verbose. But, Larry, I'm going to give it back to you, and we'll do our Q&A.
Okay, great. Harlan, thanks so much. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with the effusive praise. It was great, because I want plenty of time to get to Q&A as much as possible. So let me just give a share ID before we do that. Get ready with questions only, please, in the interest of time and so forth. The share ID for the presentation, 21725. 21725 for this morning's presentation. If you have a question for Harlan, we'll try to respectfully to keep the commentary and just get right to the question. That will make room for people. Press star 1 and give me your first name. Who has a question?
Norma.
I missed that. Biona, was it?
Norma from Texas.
Oh, Norma. Got it, Norma. Thank you so much.
Felicia S. from New Jersey.
Felicia? Keep them coming.
Linda S. from North Carolina.
Linda, gotcha. Who else? Great opportunity. Star 1.
Dara F. from Virginia.
Hi, Dara. Gotcha. Don't be shy. Norma, Felicia, Linda, Dara. Who we got so far? Anybody else? Okay. Let's start with that and get ready. You know, after that, we'll certainly have more time. Let's start with Norma. If you're not Norma, please mute your phone by pressing star 1 again. Norma, what question do you have for Harlan?
Yes, yes. Thank you, first of all, for this presentation. It was awesome. But can you briefly just go through how you do a 10-step? I know you're very proficient at it, but sometimes I struggle with what to say.
Okay. All you say is, I'm mad at Fred. And I'm mad at Fred because Fred did blah, blah, blah. Well, your sponsor or your person that you're calling, if they're in recovery and they know how to do it, Norma, is going to say something like, okay, well, let's look at where you're selfish. Fred's not sticking to your script. And what's the lie you're telling yourself or someone else? That's your dishonesty. Maybe the lie you're telling yourself is as basic as that you think Fred has to stick to your script. And then we're going to look at your selfishness, your dishonesty, your resentment, and your fear. What's the fear here? Why is Fred's behavior bothering you so much? And that shouldn't take more than a minute or two. Fred's behavior is bothering you because you have a situation where he's threatening your job, and that's your livelihood, and you're afraid. Well, that's what's going on here. Okay, go make amends if you harmed Fred. If you didn't harm him, then there's nothing you can do. And then go help somebody else. I guarantee you, you're gonna you're going to feel a lot better. For further amplification, though, on this, I have a special edition that's on Vision called God's Cold Shower. And in this special edition is solely devoted to Step 10, God's Cold Shower. I'm not adept at the Vision website. I'm not real adept at it. But if you listen to God's Cold Shower, there are live examples of me doing 10 steps, both as the person disturbed and as the sponsor or the person listening to it. And then, Norma, you're going to feel a lot better. But listen to God's Cold Shower on Vision, I think it'll help you a lot. But that's how you do it. It's very simple. You don't have to write anything out. You don't have to email anybody. You don't have to text anybody. You don't have to nothing like that. It's a very simple process. You just got to get a hold of someone that's in recovery. In our zeal, OA has a zeal to make everything very complicated. There are people, they'll take you through a 10-step. It's a half-hour process, for crying out loud. Who's going to do that? How many people have a half hour to stop what they're doing? It should be very quick and very simple. In OA, if things are not quick and simple and easy, you're probably doing them incorrectly, because this is a very simple program, quick and easy. Nothing here is complicated. The Yiddish word of the day, Norma, is ungeblüzzelt. Ungeblüzzelt means overblown, overdone. Don't get ungeblüzzelt. Okay?
Thank you.
I hope that helps. No problem. Thanks, Norma.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Norma. Just quickly, because Harlan referenced it. When you go to the Vision site, at the top, it has special editions. There's a search function. You can put in someone's name, like Harlan or Joe or Tom, Dick, and Harry, right? And or the topic that he gave you, and it'll take you right there. Okay, next question from Felicia, followed by Linda. Hey, Felicia, good morning.
Felicia.
Good morning. Thank you to all who do service at this meeting, and thank you, Harlan. My question is, for those people you talk about who get stuck and ruminate, how do you help them do more than just, you know, yes, there's a God, I get that, and I'm separated from the food, but how do you help those that seem to have a resistance to that personal relationship with God?
If you're resistant to it, that means something there is working for you. You have a resentment against God. You have a resentment against the way the world is. And that resentment means you don't have to take responsibility for your own life. And if there's anything a lot of us don't want to do, it's take responsibility for our own life. We want to blame others. And one of the people we blame, or one of the beings we blame, is God. So I asked that person, is this the hill you want to die on? You know, I understand that there are lots and lots of reasons not to believe in God. I didn't win the lottery last night. I also didn't play. I didn't buy a ticket. But I didn't win the lottery last night. And, you know, I read the Chicago Tribune every day. I read it online. And one of the things they had in the Chicago Tribune this morning was they had an article about a new Rolls Royce that's coming out, and it's $560,000, over $500,000 for this car that Rolls Royce is coming out with. You know, I want one, but I can't afford one. That's not fair. I should get a Rolls Royce. Wouldn't it be cool watching me drive down the street in my new Rolls Royce? Boy, everybody would be impressed, huh? I don't get to have one. I drive a Honda. So the bottom line is, yes, there are lots of reasons to resent God, but let's knock it off, because is this the hill you want to die on? How is this serving you? How is you being mad at God because of this or that? How is that helping you? It's only hurting you. When are you going to get out of your own way, I say to people. And that was said to me. When are you going to get out of your own way? Because this is it. This is not a dress rehearsal. Some of us have more time than others. This is not a dress rehearsal, Felicia. This is it. And every day I burn fighting these battles that just don't exist against a God, against a God that I don't believe in. Every day that I do that is another day where I can't be the best person I can be. So sometimes I have to adopt a new God into my heart. How do I do that? By understanding that God is not my enemy, that God is for me, not against me, that God is with me, not apart from me. And when I want to find God, I look for him in the face of one of his children. God does not come to me in a synagogue. Synagogues are great. Churches are great. Temples are great. Those are great things. I'm not knocking that. God never came to me in a synagogue. God comes to me in the face of someone who comes in here dying of their untreated addiction, and they themselves are now sponsors. They themselves are now transformed. I look for God in the face of one of his children. And that's what I tell my people. That's what I tell myself. How is this serving you? There's a woman I go to meetings with all the time, and she would profess about how she hated God and didn't believe in God. And the real thing was her mother died when she was 9 years old. She was mad at God. She was mad at God, but she believed in him the whole time. Get mad at someone you don't believe in. Okay? So that's what I say. Thanks, Felicia, for your question. I hope that helped.
Thanks, Felicia. Next up, we have Linda, followed by Dara. Linda, good morning to you.
Linda, we can't hear you.
Star one, Linda.
Star one.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I got it.
Now we got you, Linda. What do you got?
Thanks, Harlan. Just the medicine I needed this morning. I am asking this question for myself, but also because I think there'll be a lot of people on the line who also are having the issue I'm having. I've been recovered. I'm no longer recovered. I'm so deep in that. So here's the thing. My body is suffering, but my mind is also suffering. So here's the thing. I need somebody to tell me what's the first thing to do and what's the second thing to do. So here's the thing I've heard you say before.
First,
you know, anybody can diet for 3 days. Anybody can diet for 3 days.
Right.
But when I can do that, when the first urge comes to eat and I'm not recovered, can I call someone at that point? What's
Why not?
The second? Yeah.
Why not?
I mean, what advice would you give to that person who just tries every day and loses it like 5 o'clock.
You've got to, well, then at 5 o'clock, you have to schedule things like a meeting, like phone calls or prayer or both or all of the above. You got to do what it takes. This is not a program for people who need it. This is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it. And part of doing it is not eating that food no matter how much I want to and getting on that 10,000-pound phone and making a phone call.
Yep.
Doing whatever I need to do to take that action. You have a problem at 5 o'clock? You make phone calls at 5 o'clock. You go to a meeting at 5 o'clock. You do service at 5 o'clock. You go to a meeting and they need something read, you read it. You can't sponsor yet. You're still in the food, whatever it is. If they need something read, you read it. If they need something done, you do it. You take action. You fight for your life. And you'll be amazed that when you walk to God, God will run to you. You'll be amazed that when you put that food down and you start taking action after action after action that you do not yet believe in, that miracles will happen. Why can't you make that phone call? Why can't you do the things that are going to save your life? I can't think of a single reason.
Yes. The 10,000-pound phone, that's a big one. Thank you so much.
No problem, Linda. Good luck to you.
Thanks, Linda. Okay, from another earlier era, let's go to Dara. Hey, Dara. Good morning.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, sure can.
Okay, great. This is Dara F. from Virginia. A little nervous, but I thought I'd just go for it, whatever. My question is, I texted something and I didn't mean it in the way it was taken, and the person's feelings were hurt. I was very surprised. I apologized immediately, but I'm having trouble letting the sort of rumination and repetitive thoughts of, oh, I did something wrong, I hurt this person's feelings. I'm having trouble just letting that go. Do I do a 10th step on that? What do I do with that?
You do a 10th step, you go help somebody else, and you also understand cerebrally that no matter how evolved your recovery gets, you will never rise above the level of a human being. And you're not really regretting that you did that. You're hoping that they like you. We all have a need or a want. We have a social instinct. So your fear is, or your disturbance is, do they still like me? Are they bad-mouthing me to others? And the truth of the matter is we have to earn respect every day. We have to go out there and earn it. And the bottom line is, you keep doing more right things than wrong things, you'll be just fine. And what other people think of me is none of my business. It's none of my business. We're not in the results business. You have to understand that there are things that you do because you're human. You're a human being. You're a human being. And you're okay, Dara. You're all right. Go help somebody else. Go do your 10-step. Go help somebody else. You're going to be just fine. It's going to pass. This too shall pass.
Thank you. And Gagasundheit.
Thank you very much. Thank you. All right.
Thanks, Dara. Okay. We got time for more questions. If you have a question, Harlan likes it, like on the Cubs, algebra, food. Okay, none of those topics, right? Who's got a question for Harlan?
May I ask just that?
Pete, Alexis, who else?
Hannah Yetta.
I have a Hannah. My daughter is Hannah.
Was that Leo? Did I get? I think I heard Leo.
Yes, it is me.
Okay. Pete, Alexis, Hannah Yetta, Leah. Maybe one more. I know we're pressing it towards the top of the hour, but. Okay, we can go with that group. Let's go with
Sonia N. from Pennsylvania.
Okay, Sonia, let's stop there. Okay, so if everyone other than Pete would mute their phone. And Pete, what question we got? Good morning.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for taking the meeting. Appreciate your service. Harlan, thank you. I was wondering if you could tell me what the square root of – no, that's just – I'm just kidding.
No, ma'am.
How do you suggest person working the steps acquire the habit of accurate self-appraisal?
Ooh, self-appraisal can be very dangerous. A solitary self-appraisal can be, you know, it proved insufficient. You just keep doing 10 steps. You just keep doing them when you need them, and it becomes a habit. It is not something that we do naturally. We have been told, Pete, by our culture, we have been taught by our Western culture that we can do anything. We all read when we were children, and we
lost you.
Thanks, Pete. Yeah, we lost you, Harlan. Start one again.
I don't know what happened there. Pete, I don't know where you lost me, but I'll continue answering. We are all products of Western culture. And as such, we read as children the little engine that could. And the little engine that could is, I think I can, I think I can. And he does the job, and we all cheer for the little engine that could. So what happens is, out of fear and out of culture, we try to solve our own problems. After all, we don't stand up and say, I needed other people as readily as we say, I needed no one, and I built up this business, and I'm a billionaire, and I'm this. We need other people. So a self-appraisal is very, very difficult for me to endorse as much as a appraisal of what it says here in the 10th step. It says here, we discuss them with someone immediately. And what does it say in step 5? It says a solitary self-appraisal proved insufficient. So I have to get into the habit of saying to somebody, here's the situation, and let them give me objective feedback. Because a self-appraisal, for me, can be very, very dangerous. In my twisted noodle of a mind, I can justify the most errant nonsense, the most crazy BS you've ever heard in your life, and I can make perfect sense of it. Perfect sense. So I need objective feedback. Before you go, I hope that answered your question. I hope that helped. What did Rice, or not Rice, what did Temple do yesterday? What did they do?
They got destroyed by Navy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's
right.
Okay.
Well, they needed you. They needed you in there on the line, so that's why they got destroyed.
Those days are over, buddy. But thank you.
They needed you out there, buddy. All right. Okay.
I would listen to Pete and Harlan do a sports show any day. Of course, it'd be just me.
All right. Thanks, Pete. I hope that helped. I hope that helped. Thanks for asking. Okay. Now let's go to Alexis.
Alexis, right. Alexis, you're up.
Yes, Harlan. Hi, Larry. Could you tell me who was the speaker on the cold shower?
Me.
Oh, you were. Okay.
Me. Yeah.
My brother was the fullback at Temple.
Ooh. Well, we've got a lot of Temple Temple presence here today. One of my friends, very good friend, he lives in Los Angeles. His son was the radio announcer for the Temple Owls for a few years. He was the radio announcer for Temple for several years. Okay. All right, Alexis, what do you got?
That was it.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Alexis.
All right.
Harlan, we got Hana Yetta with the question.
Hana Yetta. Not Hana Yetta. It's Hana Yetta, like you're going to ha. Okay.
Right?
I have a Hana, too. Okay. Hana Yetta, what do you got?
Okay. Thank you, Harlan, for, a masterpiece, which... it always is. I want to know, first of all, you're very lucky you have a Hana. And second, where do you get all of your background information? Are there certain books you read?
Yes.
Can you, list some of them?
You read everything. You read all of the above. You read... Pass It On. You read AA Comes of Age. Start with that. You read Google biographies of Bill Wilson. Google history of AA. Google it, and it'll show you. I don't want to name the if it's not comprehensive, I don't want to talk about it here. So you Google it, and it'll tell you. Start reading, and then read it again, and read it again, and read it again, and read it again, and it starts to sink in.
Got it. I'm glad you said that because it doesn't sink in right away for me.
For me,
the other thing I wanted to say was that I graduate. No, I didn't graduate. I finished the 12 steps.
No such thing.
I finished the first part of my 12 steps, and I got a sponsor on Friday, and I started sponsoring.
Got a sponsor? Or you got a sponsee?
I got a sponsee to help through the 12 steps, through the big
book. Okay, all right. How can I help?
I just wanted to say is that she's going to be finished with her 2 days of God willing, tomorrow, and we're starting the first part of the book.
Okay.
And are there any suggestions that you have of
go
what
quickly.
I should
quickly rather than
go
slowly?
Quickly.
Don't give her a bunch of crap writing assignments. There's no written assignments for any step other than 4, 8, and sometimes 9. That's it. And we see these books, and it takes people months and months to get through the steps. You're killing them. You're killing them. How long can you hold your water, hold your breath underwater? Get them through quickly. Get them sponsoring. I take my people through in less than 2 weeks. There's no reason that it should take this long. If you weren't half nuts, how many questions you have in some of these books, 150, 200 questions, if you weren't in an insane asylum before you started answering those questions, you'd be in a rubber. It's insane. Where did this come from? Ungeblusen is the Yiddish word of the day, overblown, ungeblusel. So the bottom line is get them through quickly. Remember always, it says on page 89, nothing ensures immunity from drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. You need to get them sponsoring or they're going to die. There's no written assignments for 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 10, 11 or 12. None. Okay. I hope that helps, Hannah.
Thank you, Harlan. Yes.
You're welcome.
You.
All right. Thanks, Hannah. Okay. We have Leah with the question followed by Sonia. Leah, good morning.
Leah and Sonia. Okay. I feel like we're at the sisterhood of the synagogue here. Leah and Sonia. Okay. Leah, what do you got? I'm not getting any of it.
Your connection's
not
great.
I can't hear you.
No, okay.
Wait,
Leah?
You know what? Now you're coming through better.
Now you're better. Now you're a little better.
Okay. You mentioned that
Leah, why don't you call back in?
Okay.
Yeah, let's do
that.
Why don't you call back in quickly,
and we'll get you in there. Get you in there, but
let's move.
Call back in.
Perfect. Let's go with Sonia, and then we'll come back to Leah. Sonia, what question do you have?
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Harlan, and thank you, God. I went through the steps in less than 2 weeks and got recovered. My question is, you distinguish the difference between spiritual experience and spiritual awakening.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is a time frame for spiritual awakening? You said it lasts longer. It's gradual. What are you talking about gradual? Like, what is gradual?
Normally, it's the rest of your life. I am recovered, but my spiritual awakening comes to me almost every single day of my life. I just spent a week with my girl, or a little over a week with my girlfriend. She lives in Arlington Heights, Illinois. And she has windows in her condo, and they overlook greenery. And when the sun goes down, because she has a western view, western vantage point, and you see that sun going down with the color, if that doesn't inspire you to believe in God, I don't know what will. I really don't. I have a spiritual awakening every time I see people recovered that came in dying. I have a spiritual awakening every time I see babies or puppies or whatever. I have a spiritual awakening when I do my 3-mile walk and I'm done. I didn't used to be able to get in and out of a car, and I can walk 3 miles. I have a spiritual awakening lots of times. Lots of times. It doesn't happen once. It happens thousands of times.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Get ready to see miracles. We also went to Lake Michigan, which I love, my first higher power. And we sit there and there's benches. It's in Glencoe, Illinois. And we look out at Lake Michigan and we see trees and birds and children and dogs and this. If you don't have a spiritual awakening there, I don't know when you're going to have one. But the most important one is keep your mind open to God communicating with you. Keep your mind open, and you will see miracles beyond your wildest dreams. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle either. Don't worry about when it's going to take place. It's taking place all around you every day.
Right.
It's taking place
exactly.
Everywhere. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, Sonia. Thank you.
Yep.
Leah, did we get you back? Leah S. in New York? Did we get you back?
I don't hear her. Maybe she tried, or maybe she was having a tough time. Does somebody else wanna jump in for the final question?
Final question.
Melinda.
Final question. Melinda.
Melinda.
Let's do that. We knew it was gonna be you, Melinda. Good morning.
Okay. So thanks so much for both of you doing service, and I want to know how to find a sponsor that doesn't take me through all these multiple assignments.
Ask them. I can't tell you how to find them other than ask them. Do you give a multitude of written assignments that takes a long time? Find the ones that don't, and those are the ones you want to grab onto, because they'll take you quickly.
What about multiple podcasts to listen to? Because I don't
podcast
have
is fine.
Time.
Podcast doesn't bother me. That's fine.
Okay.
But whatever's going to protract the time that you're in the steps is dangerous. You have to go through quickly. We don't have to become experts at the steps, or experts at AA history, or experts at the life of Roseanne, or anything like that. What we need to have is recovery and pass it on. You've got the rest of your life to teach and to do in-depth studies. Clancy Immersland is one of my very, very favorite speakers. He's unfortunately gone now. But Clancy says, we do not learn this program by absorbing spiritual information. We learn this program by transmitting spiritual information. And that means you have to sponsor. And you have to get to that point on page 89 as absolutely quickly as you can. Absolutely quickly as you can.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Melinda. And Harlan, thanks so much. We're going to wrap up this meeting. And hang tight, everybody. We're going to ask for Harlan's contact information at the conclusion of the recording. Let me give the share ID number again before we close here with the reading on page 164. The share ID number is 21,725. That's 21725. So we're going to close now with a reading from page 164 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in a chapter called A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen. All right.
All right. The board op can turn. You can conclude the recording at this.